Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, January 31st, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to be gathering around the virtual water cooler and talking about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
BJ, it's been a long time since we've done a straight up water cooler episode, so I'm excited to dive into this with you. What have you been doing recently?
Alrighty, so I am slowly but surely doing t-shirt surgery on all of my graphic tees, and I own a lot of them. I feel like I have entire drawers dedicated to just like Super Yaki and Pentagram Peter Pan and all of those like pop culture movie sort of, you know, merch companies. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting to this point where I'm realizing that I probably shouldn't own as many graphic tees as I do, but rather than just donate all of them or just stop wearing them because of some, you know, perceived, you know, adulthood appearance that I should be maintaining or whatever, I've been cutting them up into different pieces. Some of them are getting turned into halter tops. Some of them are getting turned into tank tops. Some of them are getting turned into like off the shoulder tops. Just finding new ways to style all of them. And it very much feels like I have been transported back to my live journal days when I was an active participant in this group that was called T-shirt surgery, which is how I learned how to do all of this stuff. So that's what I'm doing. So I hopefully by the end of this will not really have any graphic tees that are just plain T-shirts with like a print on them.
That's really cool. I just got rid of a bunch of old clothes. Like I went through my entire closet. I was just like sick of looking at shirts that were like 15 years old that were sitting in my closet. And I got rid of a lot of those sort of graphic tees, like the Super Yaki type of stuff that just like didn't fit anymore. But now I'm regretting doing that and thinking that maybe I should have like tried to, I don't know, cut them up and like turn them into patches or something, or make like some sort of hideous Voltron shirt where like all of the centers of each, you know, like the actual images from each shirt are somehow like sewn together to form one mega shirt or something. I don't know.
But yeah, that would have been awesome.
But yeah, it's a cool approach. I certainly have never done that myself, but that sounds like a really man, going back to the live journal days, that's a while ago, BJ.
I know. I like to pretend that I'm not nearly as old as I am, but I was very active on LiveJournal, which means I'm 1,000 years old.
Well, that actually is a pretty decent transition into the what we've been reading segment, because I read a book called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which is kind of about video games and like the early days of video games. Have you ever read this book? Do you know anything about
this? I've not, but this sounds fascinating.
Yeah, this came out in 2022, and it was on like a bunch of best, you know, book of the year type of lists. And it's about two kids who meet each other in unexpected circumstances and they bond over their love of video games. And then they reunite years later as college students and decide to make a video game of their own. And if you, like me, are part of the generation who sort of grew up playing Oregon Trail and games like that on PCs and school classrooms, which is why the live journal thing, you know, there's that connection there. There's probably a lot that you'll be able to recognize and kind of pick up on in terms of the references to games that are made throughout this book. But I don't necessarily think you have to be a gamer or anything to really get something out of this. There's like a will they, won't they aspect to the two lead characters that really drives most of the story. And it's more about that and kind of like creativity and honesty and trust and kind of these bigger ideas than like, hey, remember this game or that game? You know, it's not really like that. It's not like Ready Player One, I guess, is the best way I can say.
It's not just member berries.
Yeah, exactly. I did find myself getting frustrated by some of the decisions that a few of the characters were making, but honestly, I feel like that happens a lot in modern fiction. Like, there's just something about the way that modern, I'm, you know, I realize I'm doing like a gigantic blanket statement here, but it feels like modern writers have their characters do like make terrible decisions and be awful people. And it's like kind of tough to read that sometimes when you're just like, your entire situation would be easily solved if you just weren't such an asshole, or if you just would do this one simple thing that the characters like refuse to do. So I don't know, maybe that's just like a problem I have with like a lot of modern, like contemporary fiction or whatever. But anyway, I found like there's also some really powerful stuff in here too. So I think I was ultimately a little mixed on the book, but I would say give it a shot if anything that I've said sounds interesting. I also had a chance to read The Wager, which is a book that Jacob has recommended on this podcast before. Have you read this one, BJ? Do you know anything about this?
I've not.
Okay, so David Gran is the author behind this, and he wrote The Lost City of Z, and he wrote Killers of the Flower Moon. And The Wager is his most recent book. It came out in April of last year, and it's about a mutiny that happens after a British ship wrecks in... It's like 1741, I think is the year. And it's a survival story and a horror story, really. And like, if you've ever seen a pirate movie or like a swashbuckling adventure movie and kind of bought into the romanticized nature of that kind of lifestyle, I would say that reading this book will make you so glad that you've never actually boarded a ship during that period, because it sounds absolutely hellish. Like the you know, David Gran is like famous for his research, and you know, like the rest of his books, this one is full of rich and vivid and vibrant details. And it just, you can tell he did, again, a ridiculous amount of research to sort of patch all these stories together and bring this tale to life. And yeah, the picture that he paints of what life was like on a boat back then is just like kind of nightmare material for me anyway. So yeah, I found this to be incredibly entertaining. I'm very curious to see if Martin Scorsese does actually decide to adapt this into a movie. There was talk that maybe he and DiCaprio would reteam for this. I think since then, Scorsese has announced that he's going to be working on like a Jesus movie of some kind. So very curious to see what that ends up being as well. But yeah, The Wager is just like, there's a lot of like terrible weather and really like horrific stuff that happens to this crew as they get shipwrecked. And it just seems very, very difficult to capture in either TV or film. So I wonder if anybody, let alone Scorsese, is going to be able to ever, you know, bring that kind of story to a screen of some kind. So we'll see. But The Wager, the book, is very much worth reading, especially if you're into, any sort of like pirate stories or anything like that, buccaneers and swashbuckling of any kind. So check it out. What have you been reading recently? Anything?
Alrighty. So yeah, I'm reading the mnemonographic novel. I know I spoke on the show about getting to see the Nimona film in the theaters and how wonderful it was. I wrote about that for Slash Film as well. But at that screening, Andy Stevenson, who wrote the graphic novel, talked a bit about the original source material and how upon rereading it and upon, you know, watching the movie, he realized, oh, this entire book is just like me screaming for help and understanding what my, you know, my gender is, because Annie Stevenson has since transitioned since writing Nimona. And so I was like, you know what, now that I have this additional knowledge and I know where this author, you know, is going to end up, I want to reread it and see if I can find, you know, those little breadcrumbs left behind. It's not breadcrumbs, it's a feast. Like it is so on Front Street that, you know, this author is having some gender issues and going through it in how it is presented through Nimona's shape-shifting, how Nimona feels about the world. Really, really fascinating. And I also enjoyed revisiting it now that I've seen the movie, because I think sometimes once you see a movie that has, you know, been adapted from a book, the movie tends to become the dominant narrative in our minds. Like, this is how we remember things. It's the same way, you know, where people talk about like things that happened on the Titanic, and most of the things that they're parroting are things from James Cameron's movie and not actual history. So I wanted to reread the book to see, you know, how I feel about both of them. And I think they're both, you know, really wonderful pieces of art. But I had forgotten how much more intense and how much bigger the emotions in the graphic novel are. And I'm very glad that both of them exist, because I think the graphic novel is a little bit more mature than what the Netflix movie ultimately ended up being. So I think it's great because now we can have younger audiences watch the movie, really fall in love with it. And then when they get a little bit more mature and can handle a little bit more nuance of, you know, some pretty tough issues, then they can go back to the graphic novel. So this is now a series that can grow with the people watching it.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a cool trajectory. I didn't realize that the graphic novel was like more mature, as you said. So I haven't read it yet, but I love the movie. So I'll have to check this out too. Before we get into what we've been watching, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back. Okay, what have you been watching recently, BJ?
All right, so the first thing that I watched is actually a documentary from 2016 called Bad Kids. Have you seen this?
I have not.
Okay, so Bad Kids is about what is a continuation high school in the Mojave Desert. And for those that don't know, continuation high schools, you might have heard them as like, oh, that's the school where the bad kids go. A lot of times it's kids that have been bounced around between private, public, and charter schools. They tend to have like behavioral issues or a lot of truancy problems. A lot of times these are kids that are coming from, you know, rough homes with not a lot of support system, and continuation high schools are kind of their last chance at getting a high school diploma before it ends up being like you're taking night classes for GEDs. These schools have a completely different structure. It is very much like independent. You determine when you're going to graduate. If you want to really buckle down and get everything done in, you know, a semester and a half and leave, that's your prerogative. If you want to stay there for 5 years, that's your prerogative. But it is a school specifically to meet the needs of a lot of kids that we would typically describe as like those who fell through the cracks. It is fascinating and heartbreaking. It reminds me a lot of the schools that I taught in. So I got a little emotional, but it was really wonderful. Like, it's a really wonderful watch because, you know, people are really judgmental towards teenagers, and I feel like continuation schools are going to become a lot bigger in the coming years, as we are seeing so many teachers struggle with the post-quarantine era of pandemic kids. A lot of them are struggling with emotional regulation. There's a lot more behavioral issues. If you spend any time on TikTok and end up even in spitting distance of teacher talk, you have probably heard like, oh my God, the kids today. Well, they need help. And so schools like continuation schools, I think this model we're going to start seeing a lot more of in, you know, general education populace. So it was really interesting to watch this, you know, pre a pandemic world and see how this different approach is really successful for the kids who need it.
Yeah. I wonder if they would consider doing like a follow-up documentary in that post-pandemic kind of scenario that we all find ourselves in now, because it sounds like things probably have changed so dramatically from 2016 when this first came out.
Yeah, I really hope that they do. I know that the people who made the movie and the school, it's called the Black Rock School. If they still actively work with organizations throughout the country to like help kids, you know, outside of just like their, you know, immediate geographical location. So I'm very curious if they would ever do a revisit. I think they should. Yeah. I think it'd be beneficial. And also because I want to know what happened to these kids. I want to know if they're okay.
Yeah. Did you ever see the, I want to say it's called the 7-Up series. Is that right? Does that sound familiar to you? It's,
I don't think so.
I want to say it was Michael Apted was the director. And he's directed like, I think he directed the James Bond movie. He directed one of the Chronicles of Narnia movies. But he, I think, famously directed this series of documentaries called, I'm pretty sure it's called the 7-Up series, where every 7 years he would check in with the same group of people. And he made so many installments in the series that you could watch these people, you know, almost like Boyhood, like the Richard Linklater movie Boyhood. You can check back in with these people every 7 years and see the developments that they've had in their lives and the marks that they've hit and the threshold they've crossed and like the, you know, marriages that have fallen apart and like lives that have, you know, come and gone and relationships that have happened and all this stuff. It's super fascinating because it's obviously like all real. So anyway, yeah, I would recommend checking that out if you're like in the mood for like a humanist kind of project to dig into. But where did you watch Bad Kids, BJ? So people might be able to track this down.
Bad Kids is currently available on streaming on a lot of the free places. So Tubi, Peacock, Amazon Prime freebie, free V, that's what they call it. So it's available in a lot of places for free.
Cool. What else have you been watching recently?
All right. So I am currently on an adventure to introduce a friend of mine to the entire filmography of my favorite director, Mr. John Waters. And if anyone knows anything about John Waters, he can be an acquired taste if you are somebody with a little bit more of a normie palate. I don't say that with, you know, disdain, just calling it what it is. And there are a lot of debates on how you start John Waters. Like, how do you introduce somebody to John Waters? A lot of people are like, rip the Band-Aid off, start with Pink Flamingos and, you know, have Divine eating dog poop and, you know, singing prolapsed buttholes. But I think that that's a good way to scare people out of John Waters. So I think the perfect movie to start with is Serial Mom. And I own this on Blu-ray. So we watched it at my house, made like a whole movie night out of it. And I once again was proven correct that that Serial Mom is the best way to introduce somebody into the world of John Waters, because it's culty enough that if you didn't watch the Ricky Lake show, you might not recognize that Ricky Lake is there, but you have Kathleen Turner, you have Matthew Lillard, you have these recognizable faces. It's following kind of this fun true crime thing, and, you know, making a parody of our obsession with true crime like decades before the true crime podcasting boom. So again, John Waters is always ahead of the time. She had never seen any of it. And she was like, this is hilarious. And this is so wild, and was just so shocked at the language of, you know, the obscene phone calls and everything going on. And I was like, yeah, nope, this is how you start. Perfect.
Well, I'm glad that you told me this, because John Waters is a gigantic blind spot for me as a watcher. I'm looking at his filmography right now. I don't think I've seen anything that he's directed.
Oh my God.
I know. I feel terrible, especially considering he's your favorite director. I feel like, I should be standing in a corner or something. But I'm glad that you said that, because now I will start with Serial Mom instead of diving straight into Pink Flamingos, which is the more famous movie. So
definitely. Cool. I think Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble, a lot of his early work, it's famous because it's also notorious. I love all of it. Like, I straight up own shoes that have Odorama print on them. So, like, I'm very much a diehard. But I also recognize that you gotta ease people into, you know, the everybody's on drugs and we have no money era of John Waters filmography. And some people like to say start with Crybaby or start with Hairspray. And while I also think that those are fair, those are also, you know, period pieces. And I think Serial Mom is the ticket. That's the start.
Okay, excellent. So you got one more thing that you wanted to talk about here. What else have you been watching?
Yeah, and so the last thing that I did was a rewatch of a film that I haven't watched since college, but I think, as most people know who listen, I also co-host the podcast This Ends at Prom, where we talk about teen girl movies. And given the state of the world right now, we really wanted to talk about a movie that is you know, about a very unconventional coming of age experience, one that happens during a difficult time period. So we rewatched Persepolis, Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis, also based on a graphic novel, but it is, you know, semi-autobiographical, and it's about her growing up during the Iranian Revolution and the Iranian-Iraq War, and what it was like to live in Iran, and then suddenly everything changed because of the political regime and people close to her were, you know, dying, and how that is, you know, that is some people's coming of age experience. Some of us, our biggest issue is whether or not our crush is going to ask us to prom. Some of us is, am I going to be thrown in jail because I'm listening to a bootleg Michael Jackson cassette tape? And so rewatching Persepolis, that movie is still perfect. Like, it is perfection. I still cannot believe that it did not win the Academy Award. No shade, Ratatouille, you are wonderful, but Persepolis should have beaten you, because it's remarkable. Like, it is a remarkable film, and the animation is so simple and yet so powerful, and it's very it's a very tough watch even still today, even knowing, you know, how things end up for this person. And, you know, Marjane has gone on to direct other movies. She directed that movie The Voices with Ryan Reynolds, where his pets tell him to kill people.
Oh yeah.
Like, people forget that that's the same director. But yeah, Persepolis is it's so good. Like, it is one of the best adult animated films for a reason. And it still hits just as hard as it did in, you know, what is that, 2008? But yeah, it's great.
Did we talk about Flea, the 2021 movie, the animated movie?
I think we did, like, around that time period.
Yeah, it's been so long and so many things have come out since then that I forgot. But I kind of view Flea as like a, a spiritual successor or something to Persepolis. It's kind of like some of the same experiences depicted in animation that's very much, very much aimed at adults and dealing with like serious subject matter and stuff like that. So yeah, do like a 1-2 punch with those movies. If you're looking to sort of expand your animation horizons a little bit, I would say.
Definitely.
Okay. So I had a chance to watch Ken Russell's The Devils for the first time.
Yes.
I was going to say, this seems like a BJ Core movie if I've ever seen
one. Oh, one of the t-shirts that I've been doing surgery on is my Ken Russell's The Devils shirt.
Okay. So I knew that you're the right person to talk to about this. I have to say, BJ, that like, I was led to believe from the way that people have been talking about this movie for my whole life. Like, first of all, this has been on my list of things to watch for 20 years or something, like as long as I've kind of been keeping like a running list in the back of my mind for like, oh, I gotta watch this and check this out because people say it's nuts or whatever.
And to be Ken fair Russell's, to you, it's not been easy to find for a long period of time.
Yes, and thankfully it is streaming right now on the Criterion channel, which is like a huge deal for accessibility for this movie because as you mentioned, I don't think it was like it certainly was not streaming anywhere in like a legal format or anything. And then I don't know if there have been like widely viewable physical releases for this either.
Yeah, Shudder had time. It for like a small window a couple years ago.
Okay.
And that was a big deal. But yeah, now that it's on Criterion, because a lot of people don't have Shudder. So yeah. It's been a bigger deal.
Yeah. So I kind of thought this movie was going to be way more transgressive than it was just from like the hushed tones with which people spoke about it. And I kind of think that Benedetta, which is another movie that is set in a similar milieu, if you will, was more kind of like extreme and boundary pushing. But I guess like for the time, The Devils came out in what, 74, in the mid 70s, I think. You know, obviously, like, it's not a 1-to-1 comparison with Benedetta, which just came out a couple years ago. But yeah, it just wasn't quite as like, oh my God, this is so shocking kind of thing. Like, I feel like Benedetta, some of the stuff that happens in Benedetta is actually more, blasphemous, if you want to call it that, or like shocking with a capital S than anything that happens in The Devils. But I still enjoyed the movie. I thought it was much more to me, it was not as much about like, shocking the audience to its core, but it felt like more of a real movie to me, if that makes sense, than just like a shock thing. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of about power and control and like using the sheen of institutions to manipulate and deceive people, and how blindly giving in to spectacle can maybe bring about the downfall of society as a whole, you know? So like there's a lot going on here and a lot to chew on. And it's much more than just like, whoa, look at this crazy stuff that happens on screen. So I was kind of like surprised in a multitude of ways watching The Devils. But why do you like this movie so much?
So I feel about The Devil similarly to the way that I feel about Possession, which is that a lot of people do talk about it like, this is the most extreme thing you've ever seen. And it's like, well, one, that's relative. And two, don't put that on a movie, because if you haven't seen it, your imagination is going to think of way worse things than what the movie is actually going to show you. Mm-hmm. But my love of this is, one, I have an affinity for any film that scares, you know, the general public during the time of its release. And I especially love it, like you said, like when you compare it to something like Benedetta, where it's like, you know, the devils walked so Benedetta could, you know, sprint. Like that's the way that I have to look at it. But the reason that I love this movie is close to why you like this movie. I love the idea of like, let's look at this religious institution and show on its face, like how manipulative it is, how people straight up lie for their own gain. And because they have this allure of, oh, they're a man of God or, oh, they're a woman of God, that we are supposed to just take what they say and accept it, because a lot of like blind devotion has been responsible for much of the horrible things that have happened in all societies across the entire world for the entire annals of history. Yeah. So I love that this movie is like, no, these people suck, which I love. And also just, you know, Vanessa Redgrave is incredible and I will watch her do anything ever.
Excellent. Yeah. So I would recommend checking that out. It's on the Criterion channel right now, but like, yeah, maybe steel yourself if you've never seen, I don't know, capital P provocative movies before, because it is like, it does go to places. It does have like shocking imagery in it, but it's not, I don't know. I think it was just a case of like, maybe it was built up a little bit too much with the conversation around it, or I allowed it to be built up by listening too much to that conversation instead of just like engaging with the movie on its own. But I finally did have a chance to watch it, and I'm happy that I did. So on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, BJ, I rewatched The Princess Diaries for the first time in a long time. This movie came out in 2001. It was like the big sort of starring role for Anne Hathaway. Was it Gary Marshall that directed this? Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. Just a really, really well done, you know, coming of age story that I feel like, I don't know, you are much more tapped into this corner of cinema than I am, given the subject matter of your podcast. But it kind of feels like they don't really make movies like this anymore. Am I wrong? Am I just romanticizing this period? Or do they not actually make as many movies like this anymore?
Oh, no, they straight up don't make them like this anymore, because The Princess Diaries is such a sincere movie. And if you're going to make a movie like this, then it ends up being something like a Princess Switch movie with Vanessa Hudgens, where it ends up being, you know, almost a wink at the camera. We know how goofy this is. Don't take it seriously. Let's have campy fun. Mm-hmm. It's not very off, or it's like melodramatic teen drama. But a movie like The Princess Diaries, which is just like fun and very light, and the stakes are not super high, and there's a lot of these like really wonderful character moments, those don't really exist in the teen space anymore. There are, you know, a couple exceptions, but not really. And The Princess Diaries, oh, it's just such a warm blanket. I love this movie so much. I do not love the sequel, but that's an entirely different discussion.
Oh yeah, I never saw the sequel. I just know that Chris Pine was in it, and that was like one of the early Chris Pine roles. Mm-hmm.
But, and he is real hunky and sweet in it. I just hate that movie.
Oh, bummer. But this one is delightful. Anne Hathaway is really great, and you can see why. I mean, she immediately has that sort of superstar potential. And you know, just watching her in something like Eileen, and then going back to the beginning, I don't know if this was actually her first movie, but certainly like her first big starring opportunity. There's just, it's such a pleasure to see somebody develop such a fascinating career and like, you know, go on to do all these big things coming from, you know, the kind of Disney school. Like it happens sometimes, but like, I would say just as often people, you know, have that kind of, they get locked into that Disney Channel style of acting and they just like can't transition into, you know, different type of modality of storytelling or whatever, or a performance or something. Right. So like, I was just happy to see that Anne Hathaway was able to make that transition. And she didn't also, it's not like this movie is like her playing to the back row. Like so many of those Disney Channel performers, she actually has like a little bit of naturalism here and like feels like a real person. So it was just very nice to see. And Julie Andrews and Hector Elizondo are like fantastic to watch. And it's just, just a really, really good, like warm blanket of a movie. Yeah, so if you're looking for,
it's so wonderful. And you were right. This is her feature film debut. She had been on a TV show called Get Real that no one has seen. So no one remembers that it even exists. but she was on that for, I think, like a season. And then she got The Princess Diaries. And what's also fascinating is that she was supposed to be Christine Daae in the Phantom of the Opera movie, but couldn't because she had to do The Princess Diaries too, because she was contractually obligated.
Which I didn't know that.
That's one of my like Roman empires of like, what would that movie have been like? What would her career have been like if like that was a movie that she had done? But
I really like Emmy Rossum in the
I do too.
Yeah, that the version of that movie that I think was Joel Schumacher that directed that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And like that was the project that introduced me to Emmy Rossum, and I had like a big Emmy Rossum phase for like many years. And so in that what if scenario, I wonder if Emmy Rossum would have found something else that kind of put her on the map in that same way.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see like how these, you know, little decisions, you know, change everything, but yeah, Princess Diaries is so good. And also, people who might not know this, the Baroness in the Princess Diaries, that is Bonnie Aaron. That is the nun in High Glam, which is why
it
makes me so angry whenever people are like, oh, the nun is ugly. I'm like, I'm sorry. Have you seen the Princess Diaries? Bonnie Aaron's can get it. She is mean and scary and hot, and I love her.
Amazing. Okay, well, Princess Diaries is streaming on Disney Plus if you're, I don't know, it's kind of like a perfect, like, I'm sick. I don't really feel well. I just kind of want to lay on the couch and not really think about anything type of movie where it just like leaves a smile on your face. And Robert Schwartzman is in it. He plays the sort of male lead kind of like quasi romantic interest. And yeah. And he does this insane thing where he plays the keyboard with M&Ms on it, which is just like makes absolutely no sense, but it's like a memorable visual. Like I saw this movie in theaters and haven't really, I don't think I've seen it since, but I remembered that moment just because it's so distinctive. And like,
and you have the sorry pizza with M&Ms saying sorry on the pizza. And Heather Matarazzo just being perfect in this movie. This movie's perfect. I have no complaints. It's perfect.
And Robert Schwartzman was, first of all, he's one of the Coppola.
He's a Schwartzman.
family, you know, one of the members of the Coppola umbrella, basically, related to Jason Schwartzman, Nicolas Cage, Sofia Coppola, all these people. And he was the lead singer of Rooney. I don't know if you're familiar with the band
Rooney. I love Rooney.
Yeah, I was a big Rooney fan for a long time too. So it kind of like blew my mind to find out, because I think I came to Rooney in like 2004 or three or something like that. And then to retroactively realize that like the lead singer played the male love interest in the Princess Diaries was kind of a crazy thing. So anyway, that was my experience with the Princess Diaries, rewatching that, very enjoyable. The last thing I wanted to mention real quick is I watched the final season of Hilda. Have you caught up with this yet, BJ?
I love Hilda. Hilda is definitely, I'm about to go to sleep. I would like some comfort before so I can just wash away the horrors of the world.
I know you and I have talked about the show in the past, and it's, yeah, like one of the best sort of kids shows, or like, I don't even have kids, but I watch it. It works just as well for me. And the final season of the show came out, I think at the very end of December, or maybe the early January or something. And my wife and I caught up with it, and I would say that like the first half was a little shaky. Like it introduces a character that you've, I'm trying to be vague here. It introduces a character who's never been a part of the series before and asks you to invest in relationships that we've never actually seen depicted yet. And I kind of thought that was like a bold strategy for the final season of a show. But by the time it all wraps up at the end, I thought it was like very effective, and everything kind of like came and fell into place. So very happy with how this show and its entire journey went along. I would say like overall, I think the first two seasons are like a little bit more consistently great all the way through, but like overall the show is capital G great. So it's called Hilda. It's streaming on Netflix. Just really wonderful stuff. So did you see the final season? Did you have any thoughts on that yet?
I'm a couple episodes short.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I'll be curious to see what you think about like the actual final episode in particular. So, okay. What have you been eating recently, BJ?
All right. So I think I've talked about this on a water cool episode before, but I am a person who ends up in like safe food modes. This is like, it's a very neurodivergent thing where suddenly you just get it in your head of like, the only thing I want to eat is macaroni and cheese, and then like that's all you eat for a month. I'm having that right now with pineapple fried rice. There are a lot of Thai food places in my neighborhood, and because I'm so severely immunocompromised, I do a lot of door dashing. Don't worry, I tip very well, because thank you all for allowing me to eat more than just like SpaghettiOs out of a can. So I have been on a quest to try to see who has the best pineapple fried rice in my neighborhood. I've had like 8 different Thai places over the last like 3 weeks. because I love Thai food, but I'm also allergic to fish. And a lot of things use fish sauce or have shrimp in them. And pineapple fried rice is one of the few things that I could very easily just be like, no shrimp, and then I'm fine. I don't have to worry about like changing everything and how they make it. Mm-hmm. So that's my journey right now. Right now, there's this place called like Angel Thai that is like killing it for me. I think it's in Burbank. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But that's been the one that I've been like yeah, this is it. But I also have Thai food places in the area that are have like fun names like Tie Me Up. Also pretty good.
Have you ever had pineapple fried rice that's served to you in like half of a full pineapple?
Yes. I had that one time at this like, you know, bougie place in, you know, like downtown LA somewhere. And I was shocked and it was very cool. And I was a big fan.
Yeah, I love it. The novelty is fantastic. Great stuff. Yeah. Pineapple fried rice, like one of my favorite, I don't know what you would call it, Asian foods, I guess. So, because I feel like there's more than just Thai food. Like you can have pineapple fried rice in a bunch of different sort of, I don't know, Asian variations of food, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, man, just a classic banger of a meal right there. Okay. The final category is what we've been playing. What have you been playing recently, BJ?
All right. So I have to preface this by saying by playing, I've just been, you know, being the little brother in my own marriage and just watching my wife play, because she plays when I'm working. So I'm usually just like sitting doing, you know, my daily work at slash film and just like peeking over my laptop and watching her play Super Mario Wonder. This is the cutest game I've ever seen in my life.
I don't know anything about this. What is this game?
Oh my God. Okay. So Super Mario Wonder, it's like their new, it's their new Mario game. It's their new big release. And there's all these different worlds and you can play as like all the different characters as usual, but they've incorporated so many different elements. Like there are levels that are like musical where like the piranha plants are singing and you like bop them and it changes either the notes they're making or how many of them are singing. It is so ungodly cute. Like I can't even process it. They, you know, Mario also can be an elephant and like stomp around, like, you know, when he puts on like the cap and changes animal forms, he has an elephant form and he can stomp around and like break things. it's so joyful. Like it has all of, you know, the traditional staples of a Mario game, but has incorporated all of these, you know, new elements that make it feel fresh, but it is so cute. It is like the similar side scroller. So it's not as open world as some of the other like recent Mario games, but oh my God, I loved it. It's so cute. And now that she's beaten the game, I can try and take way more time to beat it because I'm terrible at video games.
Well, that sounds delightful. Is this for Nintendo Switch?
Yeah, it's on the Switch, but I think it's on other platforms. Maybe not. I feel like it should be exclusive to the Switch. I don't know how video games work. I'm really bad at this.
Yeah, I think mostly Nintendo stuff is exclusive to the Switch right now. But yeah, just checking. So Super Mario Wonder. Okay, I'm going to add this to my list. I might have to at least watch those videos.
Trailer about it. And you're going to be like, oh my God.
Amazing. Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to our newsletter. There's a link for that in the show notes as well. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a ton. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. I would really appreciate that. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.